The Lead Masks. On August 20, 1966, a young man flying a kite on Vintem Hill in Niterói, Brazil, stumbled across two bodies lying side by side in a clearing. They were positioned with unnatural precision, flat on their backs, undisturbed by scavengers or weather. Both men wore formal suits beneath heavy raincoats, despite the summer heat, and both wore crude, handmade masks constructed from lead sheets, covering their eyes completely. The men were identified as Manuel Pereira da Cruz and Miguel José Viano, both electronics technicians from the nearby city of Campos dos Goytacazes. They had traveled over 250 miles to reach this remote hilltop. Witnesses reported seeing them purchasing the raincoats and lead material hours before their deaths. They appeared calm, unhurried, and deliberate in their actions. Inside the pocket of one of the men, investigators found a small, water-damaged notebook. On one page, written in neat block letters, was a message: 1630B at the agreed place. 1830 ingest capsules. After effect, protect metals. Wait for mask signal. There were no other instructions. No names. No explanation of what the capsules were, or what the mask signal referred to. The note was not a suicide letter. It read more like a technical procedure, a set of sequential tasks to be completed with precision. Autopsies were scheduled, but never completed. The bodies had decomposed significantly in the tropical heat, and the local coroner's office delayed the toxicology tests indefinitely. To this day, no chemical analysis has ever been performed. The cause of death was never officially determined. What is known is this: both men had money in their wallets, untouched. There were no signs of struggle, no defensive wounds, no indication of foul play. Their positioning suggested they had laid down willingly and remained motionless until death. Investigators interviewed friends and family. They learned that da Cruz and Viano were members of a local group interested in spiritualism and what they called scientific mysticism. The group reportedly conducted experiments involving altered states of consciousness and claimed to be preparing for contact with higher dimensional beings. Several members mentioned the men had been preparing for an important event, but refused to elaborate. One witness recalled seeing two men matching their description on Vintem Hill the evening before their bodies were discovered. They were standing motionless, staring upward at the sky. When approached, they did not respond. The lead masks themselves have never been satisfactorily explained. Lead blocks electromagnetic radiation. If the men believed they were going to encounter something that emitted dangerous frequencies, the masks might have been intended as protection. But protection from what, and why only the eyes? Decades later, a similar case emerged. In 1971, another man was found dead under nearly identical circumstances on the same hill. He too wore a lead mask. He too had no clear cause of death. The Brazilian authorities closed the case in 1966, citing insufficient evidence. The notebook, the masks, and the clothing were never preserved as evidence. Most of the original files have since disappeared from public record. No capsules were ever found at the scene. But the instruction was clear: ingest them at 1830, then wait. Wait for the signal. Whatever that signal was, it never came. Or perhaps it did, and the two men on Vintem Hill were the only ones prepared to receive it. The Beale Ciphers. In January 1822, a well-dressed stranger arrived at the Washington Hotel in Lynchburg, Virginia. He gave his name as Thomas J. Beale and paid in advance for an extended stay. The innkeeper, Robert Morris, noted that Beale was polite, educated, and spoke with careful precision. He revealed nothing about his business. Over the next 2 months, Beale became a familiar presence at the hotel before departing without explanation in March. 2 years later, he returned. This time, his visit was brief. On the morning of his departure, Beale handed Morris a locked iron box. He instructed the innkeeper to keep it safe and emphasized that it should only be opened if Beale did not return within 10 years. Morris agreed. Beale left the hotel and was never seen again. In May 1845, 23 years after their first meeting, Morris finally opened the box. Inside were three sheets of paper, each filled with rows of numbers. Accompanying them was a handwritten letter from Beale, dated 1822. The letter explained that the numbers were ciphers. It claimed that Beale and a group of 29 companions had discovered a rich vein of gold and silver in the Western Territories during a hunting expedition in 1817. Over the course of 2 years, they transported the treasure back east and buried it in Bedford County, Virginia, in a stone-lined vault 6 feet below ground. The letter stated that the three ciphers contained the exact location of the vault, a detailed inventory of its contents, and the names of the men to whom the treasure rightfully belonged, along with instructions for distributing their shares to next of kin. Beale wrote that the key to decoding the ciphers would be sent to Morris separately. It never arrived. Morris spent the remainder of his life attempting to crack the code. He failed. Before his death in 1863, he entrusted the papers to a friend, whose identity was never disclosed. That individual worked on the ciphers for over 20 years and eventually achieved a breakthrough. Using the United States Declaration of Independence as a key, he successfully decoded the second cipher. The decoded message described the treasure in exact terms: 2,921 pounds of gold, 5,100 pounds of silver, and jewels worth approximately $13,000 in 1820s valuation. Adjusted for modern prices, the hoard is estimated to be worth over $60 million. The cipher even specified that the treasure had been deposited in two separate shipments, in November 1819 and December 1821, and had been buried 4 miles from a tavern in Bedford County. But the second cipher revealed nothing about where the treasure was hidden. That information, according to Beale's letter, was encoded in cipher number one. Cipher three allegedly contained the names and shares of the rightful heirs. Both remain unsolved. In 1885, the ciphers were published in a pamphlet by an anonymous author, believed to be the same man who decoded cipher two. The pamphlet sold poorly and faded into obscurity. Over the following century, cryptographers, treasure hunters, and code-breaking organizations, including the National Security Agency, attempted to solve the remaining ciphers. None succeeded. Modern computational analysis has revealed anomalies. The letter frequencies in cipher 1 and cipher 3 do not match the expected distribution of English plaintext. Some cryptographers believe the ciphers were never meant to be solved. Others argue that the key text has been lost or was intentionally obscured. In the 1960s, statistical linguists concluded that the story itself contains inconsistencies. No historical record of a Thomas J. Beale matching the description exists in any known registry from that period. No expedition matching the timeline has been documented. Bedford County has been excavated repeatedly. No vault has ever been found. Somewhere in Virginia, there may be a stone vault 6 feet underground, or there may be nothing at all. The ciphers do not lie, but they do not speak either. The Dyatlov Pass. On January 27, 1959, a group of 10 experienced hikers departed from the city of Sverdlovsk in the Soviet Union, bound for Otorten Mountain in the northern Urals. They were led by Igor Dyatlov, a 23-year-old engineering student with multiple winter expeditions behind him. Every member of the group was a skilled cross-country skier, certified in mountaineering, and accustomed to sub-zero survival conditions. One member, Yuri Yudin, turned back early due to illness. He was the only survivor. The group was expected to send a telegram upon their return by February 12. When no message arrived, a search and rescue operation was launched on February 20. On February 26, searchers located the campsite on the eastern slope of Kolet Sayakal, a mountain whose name translates from the indigenous Mansi language as Dead Mountain. The tin had been cut open from the inside. Long, deliberate slashes ran through the canvas. It was still partially intact, with most of the group's gear, clothing, and food left behind. Footprints led away from the tent, down the slope toward the tree line over a mile away. The prints indicated that several members of the group had been barefoot or wearing only socks. Others were a single boot. There were no signs of a struggle at the campsite. The first two bodies were found beneath a large cedar tree at the edge of the forest. Both were shoeless, dressed only in underwear. Their hands showed signs of severe frostbite, and broken branches on the cedar suggested they had attempted to climb it, possibly to see something in the distance. A small fire had been lit at the base of the tree, but had burned out. Three more bodies were discovered along a path leading back toward the tent, spaced at irregular intervals. One of them was Igor Dyatlov. All appeared to have succumbed to hypothermia. Their positioning suggested they had been trying to return to the camp, but collapsed from exhaustion and cold. 2 months later, the final four bodies were found buried under 4 meters of snow in a ravine 75 meters from the cedar tree. These bodies presented a different profile entirely. Lyudmila Dubinina was missing her tongue, eyes, and part of her upper lip. Semyon Zolotaryov was missing his eyes. Alexander Kolevatov had severe skull deformities. Nikolai Thibault-Brignoles had major skull fractures. Dubinina and Zolotaryov both exhibited massive chest trauma, fractured ribs, internal bleeding, but with no corresponding external wounds. The medical examiner compared the force required to the impact of a high-speed car collision. The clothing recovered from the ravine victims showed another anomaly. Tests revealed traces of radioactive contamination, far exceeding normal background levels. The contamination was localized to specific garments and inconsistent across individuals. The Soviet investigation concluded on May 28, 1959. The official cause of death was listed as a compelling natural force. No further explanation was provided. The case files were classified and sealed. The region surrounding Kolet Cycle was closed to hikers and expeditions for the next 3 years. Witnesses reported strange aerial lights over the region on the night of February 1st. Multiple independent sightings described glowing orange spheres moving silently across the sky. Military personnel stationed in the area confirmed similar observations in their logs, though these entries were later redacted. In 2019, Russian authorities reopened the investigation. After reviewing avalanche simulations and trauma patterns, they concluded that a rare slab avalanche had caused the incident. The theory proposed that a delayed snow collapse caused the hikers to flee the tent in panic, leading to hypothermia and traumatic injury. But it does not explain the radiation. It does not explain the missing soft tissue. It does not explain why experienced climbers would cut their way out of a tent rather than exit normally, or why they would flee without adequate clothing in negative 40-degree temperatures. The tent was not buried under snow when it was found. The damage to the bodies in the ravine exceeded what falling ice or snow compression could produce, and the lights in the sky were never addressed by the official report. The group kept detailed journals. Dyatlov's final entry was dated January 31st. It described setting up camp and preparing for the next day's ascent. There was no mention of danger, no indication of distress. The last photograph recovered from their cameras showed the tent being erected on an open slope, in calm conditions, under fading daylight. Whatever happened next occurred in darkness and in silence. The Aurang Medon. In February 1948, multiple ships navigating the Strait of Malacca received a distress signal transmitted in Morse code. The message originated from a Dutch freighter identified as the SS Aurang Medon. The transmission was erratic, fragmented, and escalating in desperation. The first message read, "All officers including captain are dead, lying in chartroom and bridge. Possibly whole crew dead." There was a brief pause. Then a second transmission, less coherent. "I die." The signal went silent. Two vessels in the vicinity, the American merchant ship Silver Star and a British military patrol, altered course to intercept. Both confirmed receiving the same transmission. The coordinates placed the Aurang Medan in the narrow shipping lane between Sumatra and Malaysia, drifting without power. The Silver Star arrived first. Crew members reported no visible damage to the ship. There was no fire, no listing, no signs of collision or hull breach. The vessel appeared intact, but there was no movement on deck, no response to hailing, and no flag signals. A boarding party was assembled. What they found has been recounted in multiple testimonies, declassified naval logs, and journalistic reports from the era. The entire crew was dead. Bodies were scattered throughout the ship, on the bridge, in the chart room, along the corridors, and inside the cargo hold. Every face was frozen in an expression described as abject terror. Eyes wide open. Mouths agape. Arms reaching outward, as if defending against something unseen. The ship's dog was found dead in the same condition, teeth bared, mid-snarl. There were no wounds. No blood. No signs of struggle or physical trauma. The bodies had not been moved or disturbed. The positions suggested they had died suddenly, simultaneously, and in complete panic. One crew member from the Silver Star reported that the temperature below deck was unnaturally cold, despite the equatorial heat outside. Another mentioned a pervasive chemical smell, sharp and acrid, though no leaking containers or substances were identified. The captain of the Silver Star ordered his crew to prepare a tow line. If the Aurang Medan could be brought to port, a proper investigation could be conducted. But before the line could be secured, smoke began rising from the lower hold. Within minutes, the fire spread rapidly. The boarding party evacuated. Moments later, a violent explosion tore through the cargo section. The Aurang Medan broke apart and sank in less than 10 minutes. Taking the bodies, the logbook, and any physical evidence with it. No cargo manifest was recovered. No crew list was ever published. Inquiries sent to Dutch maritime authorities in the years following the incident returned inconclusive or contradictory information. Some records listed the ship as a routine freighter. Others indicated no such vessel existed under that name in any official registry. Lloyd's Shipping Registry, which maintains meticulous records of global maritime traffic, has no entry for the SS Aurang Medan. The Dutch government has never acknowledged ownership or operation of the ship. Requests for declassification have gone unanswered. In the 1950s, a Coast Guard officer stationed in the Pacific claimed to have reviewed classified documents related to the incident. According to his account, the Aurang Medan was transporting a cache of improperly stored chemical weapons, likely nerve agents or experimental toxins left over from World War II. The substances were being smuggled to an undisclosed buyer. An accidental leak, he theorized, caused rapid asphyxiation and neurological seizure across the crew. This would explain the lack of visible trauma, the expressions of terror, and the sudden mass death. It might also explain why records were erased and why the ship exploded so conveniently before it could be examined. But it does not explain why there were no protective containers visible in the hold. It does not explain the cold temperature reported by witnesses. And it does not explain how a final distress signal was sent after the entire crew, including the radio operator, was already dead. In 1959, an Italian journalist published an account claiming to have traced survivors who encountered the wreck. The article was retracted days later under unclear circumstances. No follow-up was ever issued. The Silver Star's log recorded the incident in plain terms. Coordinates, time, visual description, cause of abandonment. But the names of the crew who boarded the Aurang Medan were redacted in later copies. Some versions of the log omit the event entirely. If the ship never existed, then multiple independent vessels, military and civilian, fabricated identical reports. If it did exist, then a deliberate effort was made to remove it from history. Somewhere beneath the Strait of Malacca lies the wreckage of a ship that may or may not have a name. And if the testimonies are accurate, it still holds the answers. The Somerton Man. On the morning of December 1, 1948, a body was discovered on Somerton Beach in Adelaide, South Australia. The man was lying against a seawall, legs crossed, head resting on the concrete as if asleep. He wore a white shirt, tie, brown knit pullover, and a gray and brown double-breasted coat. His shoes were polished. There was no identification, no wallet, and no signs of violence. The initial examination revealed nothing unusual. Police assumed he was a vagrant who had succumbed to heart failure or intoxication. But the autopsy told a different story. His stomach contained a partially digested pasty, his last meal, but no traces of common poisons could be identified. His spleen was unusually enlarged. His liver showed signs of acute congestion. The pathologist noted that the man's pupils were abnormally small and that there was blood pooling in his stomach lining, consistent with certain toxic exposures. Yet no substance was definitively isolated. The cause of death was listed as unknown, possibly poisoning, but no poison was named. Investigators examined his clothing. Every label had been carefully removed. The shirt, coat, trousers, all were high-quality garments, but every manufacturer's mark had been excised with precision. The only identifying feature was a small tag sewn into the waistband of his trousers that read Keen, later traced to a specialty tailor in the United States. No order under that name could be located. A detailed search of the man's pockets revealed a bus ticket, a pack of cigarettes, matches, chewing gum, and a comb. There was also an unused rail ticket from Adelaide to Henley Beach, dated the same day his body was found. He had not used it. Months passed. The body remained unidentified. Then, in April 1949, investigators re-examined the clothing and discovered a small, hidden pocket sewn into the waistband of the man's trousers. Inside was a tightly rolled scrap of paper. Printed on it were two words in an ornate typeface, Tamam Shud. The phrase is Persian, meaning ended or finished. Linguistic experts identified it as the final words of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a 12th-century collection of poetic quatrains. The specific typeface and layout matched a rare wartime edition published in New Zealand. Police issued a public appeal asking anyone who owned a copy to come forward. In July 1949, a man walked into a police station in Adelaide with a book. He claimed he had found it in the back seat of his unlocked car, parked near Somerton Beach, around the time the body was discovered. He had not thought to report it until seeing the appeal. The final page of the book had been torn out. The paper fragment found in the dead man's pocket matched perfectly. Thompson never clarified the discrepancy. She refused further interviews and moved shortly thereafter. Decades later, her daughter revealed that Thompson had lied to police and that her mother did recognize the man, but never explained how. The code has been analyzed by military intelligence, cryptographers, and computational linguists. No definitive solution has been found. Some believe it is a one-time cipher key to an unknown text. Others argue it is an acrostic or mnemonic, not a cipher at all. Still others suggest it may be nonsense, intentionally designed to mislead. In 2022, after 74 years, forensic genealogy identified the man as Carl Charles Webb, an electrical engineer from Melbourne. DNA extracted from his hair matched living descendants. Webb had no criminal record, no known involvement in espionage, and no clear motive for traveling to Adelaide under false pretenses. But the identification raises more questions than it answers. Why did Webb remove all identifying labels from his clothing? Why did he carry a fragment of a Persian poem in a secret pocket? Who left the book in the car, and why? What does the code mean? And why was it written in a book connected to a woman who claimed not to know him? And perhaps most critically, what killed him? Modern toxicology has proposed digitalis poisoning, a plant-based cardiac toxin that degrades rapidly and would have been undetectable in 1948. It causes the exact physiological symptoms documented in the autopsy: pupil constriction, vomiting, stomach hemorrhage. It also occurs naturally in certain flowers that bloom along Somerton Beach. But Digitalis does not explain the code. It does not explain the tailored clothes or the removal of every identifying mark. It does not explain why a man would travel hundreds of miles to die on a beach, carrying the ending of a poem about mortality and fate. The last line of the Rubaiyat reads, "And when like her, O Saki, you shall pass slash among the guests stars scattered on the grass slash, and in your blissful errand reach the spot slash where I made one. Turn down an empty glass." Carl Webb made one. The glass remains turned down. The code remains unsolved. The Lost Colony. In 1587, a group of 115 English colonists arrived on Roanoke Island, located off the coast of present-day North Carolina. They were led by John White, an artist and cartographer appointed as governor of the settlement. Among the colonists was White's daughter, Eleanor Dare, who gave birth to Virginia Dare on August 18, the first English child born in the New World. The colony was intended to establish a permanent English presence in North America. It was meant to survive. By late August, supplies were running critically low. White agreed to return to England to secure additional provisions and reinforcements. He departed on August 27, leaving behind his family and the entire settlement. His return was expected within months. It took 3 years. England had entered war with Spain, and all available ships were commandeered for military action. White was unable to secure passage back to Roanoke until 1590. On August 18, exactly 3 years after his granddaughter's birth, he finally reached the island. The settlement was deserted. The houses had been dismantled in an orderly fashion. Personal belongings, tools, and armor had been removed. There were no bodies, no graves, no signs of conflict or hurried departure. The palisade surrounding the colony remained intact. On one of the wooden posts, the word Crotone had been carved in clear, deliberate letters. On a nearby tree, the letters CRO were similarly etched. There was no cross carved alongside either message. White had previously instructed the colonists to carve a Maltese cross if they were forced to leave under duress. No such symbol was found. Crotone was the name of a nearby island, home to the Crotone tribe, who had maintained friendly relations with the English. White planned to sail there immediately, but severe weather forced his ships to abandon the search and return to England. He never returned. No further expedition was launched. In the following decades, scattered reports emerged. Spanish explorers claimed to have heard of English-speaking individuals living among indigenous groups inland. In 1607, members of the Jamestown colony were told by the Powhatan chief that survivors of a previous English settlement had been absorbed into local tribes before being killed during internal conflicts. No verification was provided. In the 1930s, a series of stones surfaced, allegedly carved by Eleanor Dare, describing the colony's fate. The stones detailed disease, starvation, and flight westward. Nearly all were later exposed as forgeries. One stone remains unverified. Modern archaeological excavations have uncovered 16th-century European artifacts at sites over 50 miles inland, including a signet ring and metal tools consistent with Roanoke-era colonists. DNA testing of indigenous descendants has shown no definitive link to English ancestry, though some analysis suggests limited European admixture in certain family lines. John White recorded his final thoughts in his journal. He wrote that the word Crotone gave him hope and that he trusted they were alive. He never saw his daughter or granddaughter again. The colony was never reestablished. The word carved into the post was the last message they left to the world. It led nowhere. The Axeman. On the night of March 10th, 1919, the editor of the Times-Picayune newspaper in New Orleans received a letter. It was written in theatrical, grandiose prose and signed simply, "The Axeman." The letter began, "Hell, March 13, 1919. Esteemed mortal of New Orleans. It continued, "They have never caught me, and they never will. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a demon from the hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police call the Axeman. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned." The time mentioned was 12:15 a.m. on the following Tuesday, March 19th. The city took the threat seriously. On the night of March 18th, virtually every household in New Orleans erupted in music. Jazz bands played in parlors, on street corners, and in dance halls. People who owned no instruments sang. Bars and cabarets stayed open all night. A local composer even published a song titled "The Mysterious Axeman's Jazz," which sold thousands of copies in a single day. For those few hours, New Orleans became a citywide jazz festival, driven not by celebration, but by terror. No one was killed that night. The Axeman spree had begun over a year earlier. On May 23, 1918, Joseph and Catherine Maggio were found in their home in the early morning hours. Both had been attacked with an axe while they slept. Joseph's throat had been slit with a straight razor. Catherine's head had been nearly severed. The axe, covered in blood, was left on the back porch. It had been taken from the Maggio's own woodshed. The killer had entered by chiseling out a panel in the back door, a method that would become his signature. Nothing was stolen. There was no apparent motive. Over the next 17 months, at least 12 attacks followed the same pattern. The assailant targeted Italian grocers and their families almost exclusively. He broke in through rear doors, always removing a lower panel to gain access. He used axes or cleavers found on the premises. Some victims were killed. Others survived with catastrophic injuries but could provide no useful description. Many reported waking only after being struck. The attacks occurred in the early hours of the morning, between midnight and dawn. Witnesses described hearing no sound, no struggle, and no forced entry. The doors were not kicked in. The locks were not broken. The killer worked with deliberate silence and precision. On August 10, 1918, Joseph Romano was murdered in his bed. His nieces, who lived in the adjacent room, reported seeing a dark, heavy-set man wearing a dark suit and a slouch hat standing in the doorway. He did not speak. He vanished before police arrived. Romano died from axe wounds to the head. The tool was found in the backyard. By mid-1919, New Orleans was in a state of collective panic. Hardware stores sold out of firearms and door reinforcements. Neighbors organized armed night patrols. Police increased foot traffic, conducted door-to-door inquiries, and interrogated dozens of suspects. No credible lead emerged. Then, after the letter and the night of jazz, the attack stopped. The last confirmed Axeman murder occurred on October 27, 1919, when Mike Pepitone was killed in his bedroom. His wife, sleeping in another room, heard sounds of a struggle but arrived too late. She claimed to have seen a man fleeing through the back door, but again, no identification was possible. Weeks later, a woman named Esther Albano shot and killed Joseph Mumford in Los Angeles, claiming he had murdered her husband. Some reports later suggested Mumford had been in New Orleans during the Axeman killings and had left the city around the time the murders ceased. No evidence linked him directly to the crimes. Albano was convicted of murder but released after serving a minimal sentence. No charges were ever filed connecting Mumford to the Axeman. The case was never solved. The Axeman disappeared as quietly as he had come. The Tunguska event. At 7:17 a.m. on June 30, 1908, the sky above the Tunguska region in central Siberia exploded. The blast released energy equivalent to approximately 12 megatons of TNT, nearly 1,000 times the force of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Seismographs across Europe and Asia recorded the shockwave. Barometric sensors in Britain detected atmospheric disturbances. For several nights afterward, The skies over London and other European cities glowed with an eerie luminescence, bright enough to read by at midnight. Witnesses located hundreds of miles from the epicenter described a column of blue light moving rapidly across the morning sky, trailed by a tail of fire and dust. Moments later, the horizon erupted in a blinding flash. A wave of searing heat was felt over 40 miles away. The blast wave followed seconds later, shattering windows, knocking people off their feet, and throwing horses to the ground. The sound was described as a continuous roar, like heavy artillery fire, followed by a deep, sustained rumble that lasted several minutes. At the center of the event, over 2,000 square kilometers of dense forest were obliterated. Approximately 80 million trees were flattened in a radial pattern, their trunks aligned outward from a central point. Herds of reindeer were incinerated. Witnesses closer to the blast reported being thrown into the air, losing consciousness, and waking to a landscape transformed into charred devastation. But there was no crater. The first scientific expedition to the site did not arrive until 1927, nearly 20 years after the event. Led by Soviet mineralogist Leonid Kulik, the team expected to find a massive impact basin and fragments of a meteorite. Instead, they found a forest of dead, standing trees at the precise center of the devastation. The trees were stripped entirely of bark and branches, reduced to blackened poles jutting vertically from the earth. Surrounding them, for miles in every direction, lay a radial field of fallen timber, all pointing away from this central zone. No crater existed. No fragments of extraterrestrial material were recovered in significant quantity. Soil samples showed microscopic traces of magnetite and silicate spheres consistent with meteoric dust, but nothing resembling the mass required to produce such destruction. In 1958, an expedition recovered small, glassy particles embedded in tree resin from the blast zone. Analysis showed they contained nickel and iridium in concentrations consistent with extraterrestrial origin, but their total mass was negligible. If a 50-meter asteroid had exploded overhead, thousands of tons of debris should have rained down. Very little was found. Alternative theories have ranged from a natural gas explosion to an antimatter collision to an early nuclear-like detonation caused by unknown natural processes. In the 1940s, science fiction author Alexander Kazantsev proposed that a malfunctioning alien spacecraft had exploded over Tunguska. While widely dismissed, the theory gained traction in Soviet popular culture and was never formally disproven. In 2013, analysis of lake sediment cores from the region revealed a thin layer of cosmic dust dated precisely to 1908. The findings supported the airburst theory but did not resolve why no concentrated debris field was ever located. Whatever detonated over Tunguska left the forest destroyed, the earth scorched, and the sky altered for days. It left no body, no definitive proof, and no witnesses who could explain what they had seen. The trees remained fallen in a perfect radial pattern. The center remains empty. And the sky above Siberia remembers. The spy in the bag. On August 23, 2010, police in London forced entry into a second-floor flat in Pimlico, less than a mile from MI6 headquarters. The apartment belonged to Gareth Williams, a 31-year-old mathematician and codebreaker on secondment from the government communications headquarters to the Secret Intelligence Service. He had not been seen for over a week. His colleagues reported that he had missed several scheduled meetings, but no internal alarm had been raised. MI6 did not notify police of his absence until 7 days after his last confirmed contact. Inside the bathroom, officers found a red North Face duffel bag placed in the bathtub. The bag was zipped shut and secured with a padlock on the outside. Inside was the body of Gareth Williams. He was naked, curled in a fetal position. There were no signs of struggle, no trauma, no visible injuries. The key to the padlock was located inside the bag, beneath his body. Forensic analysis of the bag revealed no fingerprints, no DNA from any individual other than Williams, and no fibers or trace evidence suggesting a second person had been present. The apartment showed no signs of forced entry. The door had been locked from the outside. The windows were secure. Williams's mobile phone, found in the living room, had been wiped to factory settings. His SIM cards were laid out neatly on a table. A specialist from the Metropolitan Police Specialist Crime Directorate conducted tests to determine whether it was physically possible for someone to lock themselves inside the bag from the interior. Over 300 attempts were made by trained personnel. Not one succeeded. The bag's zipper and padlock configuration made it virtually impossible to secure from within, particularly while already inside in a confined, contorted position. Two experts testified at the inquest. Both stated it was theoretically possible, but highly improbable, and would require exceptional flexibility and coordination. Neither could replicate it. A third specialist, a professional escapologist, attempted the feat and failed repeatedly. Williams's personal background was thoroughly examined. He was described by colleagues as intensely private, highly intelligent, and fastidious in his work. He lived alone, kept to himself, and had few known social connections. He was a competitive cyclist, an avid reader of espionage literature, and had traveled extensively for work. No evidence of foul play was ever definitively established, yet the circumstances defied logical explanation. If Williams had locked himself in the bag as part of a private act, how did he secure the padlock from the inside? If someone else was involved, how did they leave no trace, no forced entry, and no forensic signature? In 2012, the coroner concluded that Williams's death was criminally suspicious and likely involved a third party. However, no suspect was ever identified, no arrest was made, and no charges were filed. In 2013, the Metropolitan Police released a statement suggesting the death may have been accidental, the result of a private experiment gone wrong. The coroner's finding was not overturned. Williams's family rejected the conclusion. They maintained that he had been murdered and that the intelligence services had obstructed justice. They pointed to the lack of cooperation from MI6, the wiped phone, the delayed reporting, and the improbability of the physical evidence. The flat was sanitized and returned to service. The case file remains open but inactive. Gareth Williams was buried in Wales. The bag was retained as evidence. The key, found beneath his body, unlocked nothing but questions. The Zodiac ciphers. Between December 1968 and October 1969, a serial killer operated in Northern California, targeting young couples in secluded areas. Five murders were definitively attributed to him. Two victims survived, but the killer claimed responsibility for 37 deaths, a number he referenced repeatedly in letters sent to newspapers. No evidence has ever supported that claim. What distinguished this case was the communication. The killer wrote directly to the press, taunting police and demanding his letters be printed on the front page. If his demands were ignored, he threatened to go on a killing spree. The newspapers complied. On August 1, 1969, three nearly identical letters arrived at major Bay Area newspapers. Each contained a third of a 408-character cryptogram. The killer stated the cipher contained his identity. He signed the letters with a circle crossed by intersecting lines. The press named him the Zodiac. Within a week, a high school teacher and his wife cracked the 408 cipher. It did not reveal a name. Instead, it was a manifesto. "I like killing people because it is so much fun. Man is the most dangerous animal of all." It referenced collecting slaves for the afterlife and closed with, "I am not afraid because I know that my new life will be an easy one in paradise death." The misspelling of paradise was noted. Analysts suggested it was deliberate mockery. The message confirmed authorship but offered no actionable leads. 3 months later, on November 8, 1969, the Zodiac sent another cipher. 340 characters arranged in a grid of symbols, letters, and reversed text. No key. No hints. It ended with, "I hope you are having lots of fun trying to catch me." Cryptographers, the FBI, and the NSA attempted to solve it for decades. Nothing worked. Then, in December 2020, three amateur codebreakers cracked it using software analysis and pattern recognition. The solution revealed another rambling taunt with no confession or name. It read, in part, "I hope you are having lots of fun in trying to catch me. Paradise, all the sooner." Again, paradise was misspelled. The cipher was designed to waste time, but others remain unsolved. On April 20, 1970, the Zodiac sent a 13-character cipher. It has never been decoded. It may not be a cipher at all, or it contains a message no one has understood. In October 1970, a Halloween card arrived containing a circular arrangement of letters, numbers, and symbols. Decades of analysis have produced no consensus on whether it is legitimate code or decorative nonsense. The Zodiac's final confirmed letter arrived in 1974. After that, the correspondence ceased. The murders stopped. The killer vanished. Over 2,500 suspects have been investigated. In recent years, DNA analysis has been applied to saliva from envelope seals. Partial profiles exist, but contamination has prevented definitive identification. In 2021, investigators claimed the Zodiac was Gary Francis Post, a convicted criminal who died in 2018. The claim relied on circumstantial evidence and witness testimony. The FBI has not confirmed it. Multiple law enforcement agencies have applied modern computational tools to the unsolved codes. Artificial intelligence, machine learning algorithms, and quantum decryption methods have all been tested. None have produced verifiable results. The 13-character cipher remains particularly resistant. Its brevity makes pattern analysis nearly impossible, and without a key or context, it may never be decoded. The Zodiac killed in silence and spoke in riddles. His words were published. Some codes were broken. But his name remains unknown.